I would really like to see a concentrated effort in this state of developing a plan to increase housing stock of all kinds.
Low-income Alaskans are struggling for affordable housing. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, federal efforts to help subsistence fishermen in the YK Delta.
We need to get the initiative moving at the federal level as well, because things don't move very quickly around here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects, on the web at grantstation.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years, on the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Rent and housing prices are high in Alaska, and that's putting a squeeze on lower-income families in the state. The United Way's Social Service Helpline 211 is logging an increasing number of calls about affordable housing, but the outlook for providing cheaper options for families, especially in the Anchorage area, is bleak. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
The most common request to United Way's 211 line was for rent and utility assistance, followed by requests for low-income rental housing, domestic violence shelters, and transitional and temporary housing. Michelle Brown, president of United Way of Alaska, says requests for housing rose sharply in 2009 and have remained high since, especially in and around Anchorage.
We're finding a lot of callers who called us in 08 and 09 said, oh, it's the first time I've ever had to call for help. I've always been able to take care of my family. Now we're having callers that are repeat callers. They got stuck back then and they can't get out.
Last year, 211 had around 20,000 calls, and Brown says they're on track to exceed that number in 2012. Their half-year data snapshot, released July 9th, shows about 46% of callers seeking housing assistance received referrals for services. But more than half of those callers who specifically requested rent and utility assistance could not be helped. As Brown explains, the state money allocated for such assistance only goes so far.
It's small pockets of money that a couple providers have, and it runs pretty much out at the beginning of every month. And so we have about a 54% unmet need of people looking for that.
Brown says Alaska 211 workers have been troubleshooting with callers who they can't help, suggesting they start visiting food banks instead of grocery stores to free up cash for rent or utility bills. But the overarching problem, Brown says, is a trifecta of stagnant wages, increasing housing prices, and not enough affordable housing. And that's putting the squeeze on families.
A single-family home in Anchorage is far beyond the means of the average wage earner. And rental properties are now out of the range. It on minimum wage, it would take a two-wage family, you know, more than 50% of their income to rent an average two-bedroom place.
The July edition of Alaska Economic Trends, a publication of the Alaska Department of Labor, supports Brown's claims. It says Alaska housing costs rose 7.6% over the past 4 years, compared to 1.3% nationwide. State economist Neil Fried says the Alaska housing market has remained relatively stable during the economic downturn, but construction of new homes nearly came to a halt.
We did build significantly fewer new homes in the last 3 and 4 years in Anchorage. I think last year, the number of new housing units built in Anchorage was the smallest number we had seen since the early 1990s.
And that lack of inventory is driving prices out of range for people who don't make a lot of money. The average home price in Anchorage is $329,000. A two-bedroom apartment costs around $1,200 a month. And there's not much hope in sight. According to a 2012 housing market analysis for the city, the two-bedroom apartment vacancy rate is just 1.9%. Daryl Hess works for Mayor Dan Sullivan's office. He coordinates the mayor's kitchen cabinet, which is essentially a working group on homelessness. Hess says the group sent the mayor a list of recommendations in May on how to spur building.
Looking at the possibility of using public lands, municipally owned lands, waiving or reducing permitting, speeding up permitting, tax abatement, the possibility of tax increment financing.
Hess says the group is set to meet again in August, and the mayor should announce which recommendations his office will be taking up then. Michelle Brown with United Way says she wants to see Anchorage get ahead of the situation before it gets to the crisis stage.
I would really like to see a concentrated effort in this state of government, nonprofit providers, and the private sector developing a plan to increase housing stock of all kinds.
Brown says the Alaska 211 half-year snapshot sends a clear message to leaders and legislators about what they need to do to make a difference when it comes to creating more affordable housing in Anchorage. And she hopes they're listening. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The newly built Goose Creek Prison is beginning preparations to house inmates. For the last few weeks, about 30 low-security prisoners from Point Mac Farm have been in and out of the facility, testing plumbing, cooking facilities, and cleaning. Department of Corrections Commissioner Joe Schmidt says the facility is ready to go.
So far, as I say, all systems are go. There's been a few training issues, and there's been a few pipe issues, but they've been fixed, you know, quickly.
About 130 prisoners from Point Mac and prisoners from the Palmer Correctional Facility will be at Goose Creek Prison in the next few days. Schmidt says these are medium security prisoners. The prisoners that are currently being held out of state will start arriving back next summer, about a year from now. Schmidt says there are about 1,050 prisoners that need to be flown back to Alaska. Each plane seats about 110 prisoners, and Schmidt estimates that each flight costs about $250,000.
You know, we're funded for the year, but we're not going to have our prisoners there for a full year. And so that's how we're going to fund all the transportation.
Once the prisoners arrive, their family members will be able to visit them. Schmidt says the new facility will provide contact visitations as well as state-of-the-art video visitation capabilities. Schmidt says Goose Creek will be at full capacity, housing more than 1,500 prisoners by the end of 2013. Weeks before it takes more than a month off to campaign, Congress is reigniting the debate over taxes. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, lawmakers are taking votes to bolster campaign talking points.
The Senate voted down a number of small business tax provisions Thursday afternoon, most of them that sound quite appealing to both parties. And yet they failed. Senator Lisa Murkowski.
We are in the midst of yet more messaging.
Both parties are guilty of that political messaging. The Republicans brought forward a provision that would have given businesses that hire more people a tax cut of 20%. It faced a veto threat and criticism because it classified businesses with 500 workers as small. The Democratic plan that went down would have given business owners a credit up to $500,000 for adding new workers. That one never had a chance of becoming law because the Constitution requires taxes start in the House. And that political showmanship sets the backdrop for an upcoming debate over income taxes. President Barack Obama is pushing Congress to extend the Bush-era tax cuts for families making up to $250,000 a year. He's urging them to let the cuts expire for households that make more than $1 million a year. Senator Mark Begich says he likes the president's plan, but he and a few other Democrats are willing to extend the lower rates up to the $1 million level.
That's a fair compromise, and I think that gets you up to probably about 99% of the small businesses and about 99% of all the families in America and individuals.
The entire package of tax cuts is set to expire at the end of the year, and both senators indicated Congress likely won't decide whether to keep them until after the election. Until then, you'll hear coordinated messages on taxes, both in Washington and on the campaign. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, looking on the bright side when the catch is low.
What we get from the Five Kings is we're getting our kids out on the river, and we're passing on those traditions and those values.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
The Chinook salmon runs are turning out to be poor on both the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers this season. Alaska's congressional delegation is seeking a federal disaster declaration to address subsistence needs in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes reports.
The Association of Village Council Presidents requested a state fishing disaster declaration in mid-June, which would allow for emergency disaster relief. The governor's office has made no such declaration. However, a different avenue is being sought on the federal side.
There are multiple paths that we're pursuing at the federal level.
Senator Lisa Murkowski.
We can approach it through the state, which I think is absolutely appropriate. But we've also got to recognize that we need to get the initiative moving at the federal level as well, because things don't move very quickly around here.
Murkowski and the rest of Alaska's delegation, Senator Mark Begich and Congressman Don Young, are requesting a federal disaster declaration from the Department of Commerce. Their request follows one from the Alaska Federation of Natives. The delegation's letter states that the Chinook salmon returns to Alaska are weak statewide this season and have been below average in many areas in recent years. It cites burdensome salmon conservation measures that the state of Alaska has had to implement in commercial, sport, and subsistence fisheries from the Kenai to the Yukon. Murkowski says she's also contacted the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Secretary of Agriculture, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency about possible assistance. In 2010, the delegation steered $5 million to fishermen on the lower Yukon after a federal disaster was sought for poor runs in 2008 and 2009. Murkowski says the process to get the funding was lengthy.
It didn't take weeks. It didn't take months. It took years to get the dollars then through the appropriations process back out to the communities and to the impacted families. So, having been alerted to where we are, I think it's important to get moving on all tracks.
The Alaska Federation of Natives request, which went to the delegation, the governor, and the Obama administration, not only asks for a disaster declaration, but for more funding for researching and restoring the Chinook salmon runs in the Yukon and Kuskokwim. Specifically, AFN asks for $5 million for a minimum of 8 years, which is the full life cycle of salmon. The Federation requests that the funding not go through the state, but go to the AYK Sustainable Salmon Initiative as a tribal, federal, and state co-management effort. No one from AFN was available to comment. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
High water and lots of debris aren't the only things keeping fish wheels out of the Yukon River this summer. Rural Alaskans depend on subsistence to fill their freezers and root cellars for the winter. Local subsistence fishermen would normally put their fish wheels in the Yukon this time of year, but an historically low run of king salmon may keep fish wheels out of the water until chum salmon start running up the Yukon in September. KUAC's Emily Schwing was in Eagle last week, where she sat down with local fishermen.
July brings sunny, breezy days to the Yukon River. It's the perfect kind of weather for a fish wheel.
When you got your kid in the boat, you know, you're pulling up to the wheel, and you check the box, and there's a big king in there, and you see the look on their face. That's really cool.
Mike McDougall and his wife are raising 6 kids in the tiny town of Eagle. This is the last place for fishermen to catch Yukon River kings in Alaska before they pass into Canada. For the time being, McDougall has decided not to put a wheel in the water.
We just feel with the numbers that are returning at this point, that if we were to take any fish, it would be under 10 fish.
McDougall caught 75 king salmon last year. That was enough to fill 12 cases worth of pint jars and feed his family for the winter. But this year, the king salmon run on the Yukon is low, record low. McDougall says if he does fish a wheel this summer, he'll be lucky if he even catches 5 kings.
What we get from the 5 kings is we're getting our kids out on the river, and we're passing on those traditions and those values and the skills that go along with the fishing.
Yeah, everything that Mike said 100% is the exact reason why we're making the same decision.
Wayne Hall and his wife Scarlett live 6 miles downriver from Eagle. They have one son who grew up working a fish wheel in the summer. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game estimates that approximately 100,000 fish make up this year's Yukon River Chinook run. In the 1980s, run sizes were three times as large, but numbers started to decline in the late 1990s. Hall says harvest patterns have to change drainage-wide if the Chinook run is to survive.
I think it's important for the mentality to take what you need and not what you want. That means voluntarily cutting back.
The Halls and Mike McDougall usually get together with Andy Bassage to work a fish wheel each summer. Bassage serves on the Eastern Interior Subsistence Regional Advisory Council as part of the Federal Subsistence Management Program. He says he knew the day would come when he might not put his wheel in the water.
This isn't the first time that a resource has declined. The one thing that has changed, though, since about 30 years ago, 35 years ago, was the commercialization and the dependence on the fish for the economy in up and down the river. And it's not just the lower river, it's all up and down the river.
All three families say they remain hopeful. Fish and Game has projected a summer run of chum salmon between 1.5 and 2 million fish. Currently, that run is on the high end of the forecast. Those numbers may indicate a good fall chum run in September as well. Bassage may still put his wheel in the water this summer to catch a few smaller male Chinook. He says he has definite plans to target the chum run in the fall. Reporting in Eagle, I'm Emily Schwing.
The Department of Health and Social Services saved more than $1 million last month when it paid a $1.7 million fine due the federal government for failing to provide adequate security for medical records that were stolen. Commissioner Bill Struer says the state faced a $3.5 million fine, but federal officials offered to settle for half that amount if the payment would come immediately. Struer said he had to look hard to come up with the money since it had not been included for that purpose in this year's budget. He says the money came from reserves that would have been reported in next year's budget.
We were awarded several bonuses this past year, for performance in our CHIP program, performance in our food stamp accuracy, and those reserves, which end up showing up in a supplemental that's submitted for next legislative session, provided the funding for that. Some of it was the majority of it was general fund, and we will have to submit an amendment with it.
Struer says no departmental program has been short-funded in order to pay the fine. Normally, judgments, fines, and settlements are taken before the legislature for final approval before any payment is made. However, because of the savings involved, the department is getting praise from legislative sources over the transaction. Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker is chairman of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. He appreciates the savings and says next year's legislature will likely ratify the expenditure during the normal budget process.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Providence Imaging Center, providing diagnostic mammogram results to patients within one working day, led by Drs. Denise Farley and Heather Tauschik, provimaging.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. As long as there are veterans, the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks will never forget them. Throughout the year, Elks members in your community lend a hand, donate money, and volunteer time. It's not something they feel they have to do, it's something they want to do. Join with America's veterans in saluting the efforts of your local Elks Lodge. Information at elks.org, Elks Care, Elks Share. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Elks Association.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Lorelei Kinneen. This week on AK, Independence. The 4th of July in Alaska is all barbecues, parades, and, depending how south you are, fireworks. But for one man in Unalaska, Independence Day came a week later. Kong Dang, a South Sudanese refugee, observed the first anniversary of his homeland's independence by celebrating vicariously through relatives half a world away. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has this story.
Kong Dang starts his shift at 6 every morning. He puts on extra tufts and a hard hat, exits his company housing, and walks across the Westward Seafoods complex to check on the processing plant's pumps. As an environmental compliance officer, one of his biggest jobs is making sure that the machinery used to process fish waste doesn't fail.
If it messed up, then which means we're going to shut down. It can shut down the whole plant.
Dang started off packing frozen seafood, and he's worked his way up to something of a mid-level position. He puts in 12-hour days, 7 days a week, for months straight. But on Monday, he got the afternoon off for the first time in a while. The break was to observe South Sudan's freedom, which was recognized last year after a half century of civil war. While Dang is now a man of 32 years, he was one of the so-called lost boys of South Sudan. It's a moniker that doesn't seem to fit him anymore in a lot of ways. He's a perpetual optimist who often talks about his faith in God, his appreciation for the United States, and his pride in his homeland. But the term is still technically accurate. Dang fled Africa in 1995 after spending most of his childhood separated from his family.
For most of my life, I live in the refugee camp, camp to camp. You know, usually there's no enough food, you know, and if you're very sick too, sometimes it's hard to get medicine, you know. It's kind of tough. Sometimes, you know, people fight in the camp too, you know, just for some reason. So it's not easy.
Dang has stories of battling near-fatal diseases, avoiding kidnap by people who would have turned him into a child soldier, and running away from violent skirmishes. He got some relief from that when he came to the United States. He had family in California, Nebraska, and Tennessee, and he bounced around among them while balancing work with education. About 5 years ago, he came to Alaska to make enough money to finish college and return to South Sudan. But that plan didn't work out.
When I came here to Dutch Harbor, I came here to just work for only one season. That's my goal, you know. That was my goal until, you know, my dad get killed. And then the family was calling me that you have to come home. They want me to come right away, but I don't have enough money.
His dad was killed near the border of South Sudan and Ethiopia in a tribal conflict over cattle. He left behind 8 wives and 40-odd children. Dang was the oldest son and had already been sending money back to his family, but now he was responsible for all of those brothers and sisters.
If you're a guy or a boy, you are responsible for your family, you know, your little sibling. So I've been doing that, you know, since I came to America. I'm still doing it right now.
Now that South Sudan is independent, sending money home isn't just about providing for his family. It's about creating human capital for a new country, paying for his siblings' education so they can become South Sudan's teachers, police officers, and bankers. Once the country is in better shape, and once he gets a chance to complete his own education, he'll return to South Sudan and start living for himself again. But this week, he just wants to reflect on how far the country has already come.
Let's celebrate it, you know, let it be happy. And then after that, when we're done with the celebration, then we can deal with the other issues that we need to talk about.
Dang's own celebration was a little subdued. On Sunday night, we tried watching early footage of South Sudan's Independence Day parades on CNN, but they were showing an interview with LL Cool J instead. And on Monday, the other South Sudanese employees at Westward ended up working extra shifts, so the small holiday party they had planned didn't happen. But Dang says he's happy anyway, just knowing that South Sudan is free and that other people are partying.
Yeah. I mean, people are like, you know, dancing right now. I imagine that right now, like especially back home, people are dancing.
One day, he says, he'll be a part of that too. In Unalaska, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're visiting Akiak, a tiny community on the southern tip of Kodiak Island.
Okay, my name is David Iluska Sr., and I'm a tribal administrator for the native village of Akiak. Oh, well, it's just a small, normal village. We've got about 20-some households that are occupied, a few vacant. Unemployment about 80%. We have a new road project going in late summer. Gonna build a new road to our new dump site and we'll put people to work, hopefully. we don't have no kind of economic development down here or anything like that. Just normal positions with city office employees and health aides and, you know, not too many employees down here. Oh, well, right now, for now, it's mostly tundra right down here around the village. We have a little ridge in the background of our community. It's about 200 feet high or so. An occasional bear now and then, like we had one last night, walked behind our houses up toward a dump site, about a 7-8 footer. Our subsistence food is so close around us. We get clams, octopus, seal, deer, ptarmigan once in a while. There's not much to do. Either mess around on the computer or watch TV, and occasionally when something comes up, we have a dance here in the community. Oh, well, we're just trying to find a way to put people to work so they don't leave and, you know, make our village a ghost town or something like that, or try to find an innovative way to keep them here in the community and not let them leave.
That was David Iluska Sr., Tribal Administrator for the Villages of Akiak. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK This Week. We had help from Alexandra Gutierrez, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Lorelei Kinneen.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Emily Schwing in Eagle. Lorelei Kinneen was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and Wendy Jonathan in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Meridian Management, specializing in coordination and management of all phases of construction projects from vision to completion, working to ensure that your project is on time and on budget. More at meridianak.com.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.